Welcome to the lecture on Hegel on History. Professor Ernest Gellner gave a talk about Hegel, which began something like this. There are only three great German theologians, I'm going to do that over and over. I'm going to call them theologians, but they're not. They're philosophers. There are only three great German philosophers, Hegel, Schlegel, and Bagel. Nobody understands Hegel. Nobody ever reads Schlegel. And Bagel, perhaps the greatest of them all, does not even exist. Indeed, as the Bagelians like to say, non-existence is the very condition of his being. Right? That's kind of the Hegel joke. That's where we are. Okay. Our seniors in the Johnson House read a short book by Hegel called Reason in History, which is actually the introduction to Hegel's lectures on the philosophy of history. The main purpose of this lecture is to provide context for that reading assignment by, first of all, reporting Hegel's life, second, sketching his place in the history of philosophy, and then three, describing how the assigned text fits into Hegel's overall project. So we'll do it in that order, life, influences, and the history book. But first, it might be helpful to have before us a very brief characterization of Hegel's thought. So here it is. You can call Hegel's thought absolute objective idealism. Absolute objective idealism. It is idealism in that it considers reality to be fundamentally spiritual or mental, rather than fundamentally physical, or even simply dualistic, you know, physical and material. Instead of saying the phrase mind or spirit over and over, let me go ahead here and introduce what might be helpful, the German word used in Hegel's tradition, Geist, which we'll have to keep saying mind or spirit because neither quite captures it. Geist is related to our English word ghost, you can hear that, and it means mind or spirit or intellect. It's got a wide range of meanings. In German, Geisteskrankheit is mental illness. Geisteskrankheit, not spiritual illness. See, that it's a hard word. The humanities are the Geisteswissenschaften, the spirit or mind sciences. But you see, none of that quite works. You know, you'd call it the humanities, the science or the knowledge about human spirit. You know, the humanities. So it functions in that way. In the lectures on the philosophy of history, Hegel says, quote, spirit may be defined as that which has its center in itself. Okay? The self-contained existence of spirit is none other than self-consciousness, consciousness of one's own being. It involves an appreciation of its own nature and also an energy enabling it to realize itself, to make itself actually that which it is potentially. Now, already, as soon as you hear words from Hegel, you notice that he has launched off into a whole realm of discourse where he seems to be looking at something and describing it, and you're not looking at it, right? Well, spirit, it's got, it's got this center in itself, so it's got self-consciousness, and it's got self-consciousness that comes with an energy to realize itself or to become in actuality what it is in potentiality. Or again, from the same book, Hegel says, spirit is essentially the result of its own activity. Now think about anything being the result of its own activity. What would that be? Oh, spirit, right? Geist. It's the result of its own activity. It has its center in itself. Its activity is the transcending of immediate, simple, unreflected existence, the negation of that existence, and the returning into itself. Okay, so again, you might have heard three beats there. The transcending of its simple, unreflected existence, the negation of that existence, and its returning to itself. This will get a little clearer as we go along, but I mean, just have to introduce you right away to the way Hegel talks. So, Hegel's idealism considers the fundamental reality to be Geist or mind. But if you ask Hegel a perfectly reasonable question, who's Geist? Who's mind? The answer is, well, not mine, not yours, not ours together, not even really a collective mind of all the smartest people, but mind itself, right? This mind that we're talking about knowing itself, it's not my mind, it's not your mind, it's not a human group mind, it's mind. Like, capitalize it, learn something from Plato, it's mind itself. So a subjective idealist might say that everything is in his own mind, or if a subjective idealist were religious, he might say everything is in the mind of the supreme somebody, that is God. But an objective idealist, like Hegel, would say that everything is mind, mind with a capital M, as Peter Singer says. Mind or spirit, that is, Geist, is really out there producing everything that is. Now, that includes me, so it's not just objective, but it's objective idealism in that it's You don't start with what's inside of me and figure out what is my mind reflecting on. You actually assert boldly, Hegelianly, that mind is what there is. Everything that is. And by everything, Hegel really does his best to mean everything, which is where the word absolute comes in the unwieldy phrase absolute objective idealism. There is nothing outside of this all-encompassing mind. Matter itself, insofar as you're going to seed it any existence at all, has a dependent existence configured within mind. Matter itself, anything finite, is produced by mind along with time and space and you and me and the whole, can I say the word matrix anymore, of everything that we're contained within. It's crucial for Hegel that God cannot be located outside or in any other way distinct from this absolute either. So it might be tempting for religious minds to say, okay, I get how the absolute is everything, and then God is looking at the everything because he made it, right? No, the absolute means absolutely everything. And so God and anything produced by God, if you're going to talk in those terms, has to be configured within the absolute. Geist just can't be divided up along the lines of creator and created in this way. Because Geist simply is the absolute manifesting itself in a variety of ways. As God, as God's creation, as mind itself, as my mind. The absolute is manifesting itself in these forms. Hegel doesn't want a clean line between God and everything else, like I want. But he also doesn't want to simply identify God with the universe in pantheist fashion. Okay, well that would be bad. I'm glad he doesn't want to do that. But if he doesn't default to a clear line between God and creation, what does he do? Again, Peter Singer, summarizing Hegel's thought here, says, it's helpful to think of Hegel's view as somewhere between a Christian view and a pantheist view. That is, Geist is manifested in everything, but Geist is not identical with everything that exists. So there you go. Everything you've ever seen, everything you've never seen, God, stuff, all of it is a manifestation of Geist. But it's not just identical with Geist. That would be pantheism. But it's not separate from Geist, because that would be sort of classical theism, and Hegel doesn't want to go there. Why doesn't he want to go there? Number of reasons. We'll unpack this a little bit later. Hegel thinks that that simple thing where you just make a distinction and say, well, look, there's God and then there's everything else, Hegel's immediately going to be the sort of irritating question asker who asks you things like, against what background are you distinguishing God from everything else? Right? As soon as you posit that distinction, tell me about the framework within which you can posit that. And how do you put them in relation? I want to name this third thing that contains the two things you just told me about. And if you name that, he'd go, aha, well, then that's the absolute. And you go, well, dang it. I didn't want to name the manifold within which God and everything else relate. But since I did, I'll call it God. No, you can't call it God because you're using Christian ideas of God. That's kind of the game Hegel plays. It's a lot of fun as an indoor activity. Anyway, hence the unwieldy phrase, absolute objective idealism. An illustration that starts with everyday experience. Here's one. I see a tree. Well, not here, I don't see a tree. I see an ugly projector hanging down from the ceiling. Let me go with the tree, because that's how I wrote the lecture. I see a tree, but if we are both manifestations of Geist, I can take that subject-object distinction, that separation between the perceiver and the perceived, and I can relativize it. Because if we're both manifestations of Geist, there's something bigger that we are both relative to. It's not some kind of absolute, here am I, there is tree. No, the bigger thing within which that is a smaller, relativized thing is it's relative to our both occupying the same world and being parts of that world or expressions of what is expressing itself in that world. You get that? That there's something bigger under there? So what's happening when I know the tree? Well, this is where it gets cute. When I know the tree, the world is knowing itself through me, right? The world, Geist, manifests itself in trees or as trees, but then it reflects on itself manifestation as tree through me. So it expresses itself as tree and as me, and I guess it has more fun manifesting itself as tree and then knowing itself as manifested as tree. And sort of that's why it put me here, is to know the tree, so that it could know itself through me. Then make one more jump with Hegel. The philosophy of history, our subject, is therefore an autobiography of the world spirit, using me, the history knower, as an instrument for self-knowledge. Thought is happening. What is being thought? The world and its history. Where? Well, in time and space. Who's doing the thinking? That's the tricky part. The world spirit is doing the thinking. How? Through me. The part of matter which developed the physiological equipment for the prerequisite of consciousness. And the highest form of consciousness is the very self-consciousness that I just walked you through, the philosophical knowledge that Geist is knowing itself through my knowing that Geist is knowing itself through me. You could probably take that another couple rounds if you wanted to. This is absolute objective idealism. As a popular philosopher Brian McGee says, Hegel regarded everything about the world and its history as the development of something non-material, a historical process that culminated in the self-awareness provided by his philosophy. And that's sort of always the cute question to ask is, so as he was writing those sentences, was he actually saying to himself, oh my gosh, the world has reached its highest point of self-consciousness in the next sentence? Or the next sentence? Well, at least somewhere in my published system of philosophy. Like, this is where it all comes to a head. He doesn't make the kind of stirring speeches you would think someone would make if they actually had that kind of consciousness. But all the lines do lead there in his thought, that this kind of self-consciousness of the idealist tradition is, in fact, the world spirit's coming to know itself and be aware of itself. And that's a higher order of being once you get there. It's one thing to be struggling along blindly doing your philosophy. It's another thing to realize that a thought is being thought through you. And that thought is the thought of the world's self-consciousness. Okay, that's the quick overview of Hegel's basic position. We'll come back to it after we review Hegel's biography. But perhaps you can already see the point in the apocryphal story reported by Kierkegaard that on his deathbed, Hegel was heard to say, "Only one man ever understood me, and he didn't understand me." Right? I don't think that's true, but again, it's one of those Hegel jokes that's out there. And it's in, I think it's reported in Kierkegaard's concluding unscientific postscript, though I couldn't lay my finger on the quote. Okay, that's pretty heady stuff. That's Hegel for you. If you haven't done the reading yet for Reason in History, there's sort of more of that waiting for you. But a little more concrete. Out of all the stuff Hegel ever wrote, we picked Reason in History because it's as clear as things ever get. And it's less than 100 pages. Yeah. Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel was born in 1770 in Stuttgart, Germany. His father was a financial officer in the German court. His mother died when he was 11. At age 18, he attended seminary in the Protestant school at Tübingen. At Tübingen, his roommates were F.W.J. Schelling and Friedrich Hölderlin. Now, we won't talk much about Hölderlin, but he's a major, major German poet. Big deal to have roomed with these two guys. Schelling, who we will hear more about later, was a boy genius who, I don't know. He and Hegel must have been around the same age, just a few years different. I think Schelling was a little bit younger. Yeah, that's right. Hegel and Hölderlin were about the same age, and they were hanging out, talking about poetry and how awesome it was and everything. And then Schelling comes to school as like a freshman when they're seniors or something like that. And he's just incredibly brilliant. I mean, I think he's appointed to a lectureship at age 23 or some, you know, unthinkable thing. Yeah, we'll say a little more about Schelling later. But there's an interesting relationship between the two in that Schelling is the boy genius who is just outproducing everybody. Hegel's just kind of galumphing along, teaching high school and being a private tutor in rich people's houses until he's well into his 40s. And then he finally starts producing his first serious things. By that time, Schelling has shut down. He's generated three whole philosophies that don't go together by the age 35 and never really writes much serious after that again. And so there's this kind of weird relationship between those two who knew each other all their lives. Schelling then has the bad taste to outlive Hegel by about 10 years. Right, so he like does everything before Hegel's even getting warmed up, then outlives him and lectures on Hegel's philosophy after the fact. So, fascinating stuff. I can't imagine rooming with Hölderlin and Schelling. They probably can't imagine rooming with Hegel. That had to be terrible. Even in seminary, all of his friends called him the old man. So the old man hanging around with Schelling, the boy genius. You know, had to be awkward. After graduation from the Tübingen Stift, the Protestant theological faculty, Hegel worked as a private tutor for several years in Switzerland and in Germany. When he inherited some money, he was finally able to stop working as a private tutor and concentrate on his own philosophical work. In 1801, at age 31, he moved to Jena, J-E-N-A, and he took the position of lecturer, or Privatdozent, private D-O-Z-E-N-T, at the university. What would that be like? first of all, you have to imagine a university as a big, really impressive place where if you are a full professor, you kind of run the whole town and you're like a god among men. But then what's a privat docent or a private lecturer? I forgot the stats on this. There were something like 26 of these guys running around in philosophy, and they were offering all these classes, and you get like 8 people in your class. And so there was kind of a competitive market for who could get appointed privat docent. But so what? There's dozens of them. It's not like you're real faculty. It's not even like you'd say, well, you're just adjunct. It's kind of, you're a lecturer. Go ahead. Try and draw a crowd. I dare you. The next few years were productive ones for him in Jena. It was sort of the hot spot. When he got there, everyone who you wanted to hang out with was there. They started leaving right away, not because of Hegel, but just things kind of broke apart. The next few years were productive. He worked closely with Schlegel, co-editing a philosophical journal, the Critical Journal of Philosophy. Critical is such a hot word in this time period that it becomes the subject of satire by the 1840s. So you know Kant wrote 3 critiques, right? The Critique of Reason, the Pure Reason, the Critique of Practical Reason, the Critique of Judgment. Fichte writes a Critique of All Revelation and publishes it anonymously. Everyone assumes it's Kant's 4th critique and it sells like hotcakes. Then Fichte says, no, I did that. And Kant says, well, that's not bad, young fella. And so that comes out. By 1840, Engels, who writes with Marx, is it Friedrich Engels, I think is his first name, writes as kind of a student piece for a joke. He writes a Critique of Critical Criticism, right? The Critique der Kritischen Kritik, because by that time, like, everyone's had enough of constant critiques. But anyway, in Jena, Hegel and Schelling worked together on this journal, the Critical Journal of Philosophy. During these years, he also produced the manuscript of his first major work, and really probably his masterpiece, The Phenomenology of Spirit, or Phenomenology of Geist, published in 1806. By 1805, Hegel received a special appointment as professor, but financial trouble and political turmoil, like, you know, the Battle of Jena, Napoleon, forced him to move away from Jena the next year. For a few years, he edited a newspaper. I don't know what that's all about, a Catholic daily newspaper he was the editor of. And then he became headmaster of a high school. A really strange period. During this time, he managed to produce his 3-volume Science of Logic, 1812. And then in 1816, when he was 46 years old, he took a position at the University of Heidelberg. In 1818, he moved to the University of Berlin, and that's kind of where he hung out for a long time. They were just really getting the University of Berlin up and running as a gigantic, nothing-can-stop-us modern research university, and he was on the ground floor of getting that established in the philosophy department. Among his major works from this period are the Encyclopedia of the Philosophical Sciences in outline, and then his lectures on the philosophy of history, his Philosophy of Right. During his long and fruitful Berlin period, he lectured on pretty much everything to large audiences as a very influential academic force. He had come to rule the place. He died in 1831 at age 61. Now, the books I just named are the main things Hegel published during his lifetime. After his death, a number of other manuscripts were published, including his early theological writings, something called The Drafts of a Philosophical System that he wrote in Jena, and a philosophical propaedeutic. A propaedeutic is a like a pre-education, and that's something he drafted at the high school, or what they call the grammar school, that he was the headmaster of. I guess he actually tried to teach the phenomenology of spirit to, you know, pre-college students, and I don't know how that went. That's got to be fascinating, right? Anyway. That's the time during which he produced this philosophical propaedeutic, which I've never even looked at. I'm interested in that, but haven't looked at it. So those are posthumous works. He did not see those through the press during his lifetime, but when he died, they published them. And then even after these posthumous works, there are some very important works assembled from students' lecture notes, which the Rutledge Encyclopedia of Philosophy calls Hegel books neither written nor published by Hegel. I think that's kind of a confusing thing to call these works. They were sort of dictated by Hegel in a classroom from a manuscript, but under pressure with an audience where he was throwing in lots of extra things which were brilliant and complex, and students took notes, and then you could collate the notes and figure out what Hegel said. Rolf Peter Horstmann points out the ironic fact that some of Hegel's most influential texts actually have the status of secondhand sources, and that does include the lectures on the philosophy of history. So it's a book by Hegel, but he presented it from a manuscript which I think did not survive, and then it has been reconstructed from student notes. So it's by Hegel. But if you notice in the typography of the book Reason and History, you'll get things in brackets and things in italics and weird footnotes like from manuscript A, because they're having to put together a critical edition from multiple people's notes. There was great demand for these extra texts, and they have been very influential. They include lectures on aesthetics, which have been widely read, lectures on the history of philosophy, and lectures on the philosophy of religion, which I've used a lot in my work, and then our lectures here, the philosophy of history. Now, Hegel's place in the history of philosophy, and as I develop this, I'll try to develop a little more of a well-rounded view of Hegel's own philosophy, just by positioning him. Hegel's position in philosophy. You could always start with the pre-Socratics, but I think it's kind of rude to start any philosophy lecture with the pre-Socratics. If you're listening to something from the 19th century and the professor says, we really have to start with Thales, you should leave politely, right? Because it just shows a little lack of restraint. Because, yes, all subjects start with the pre-Socratics. That's just how it is in Western thought. I'm going to skip all of that and jump in with Kant, okay? To skip a few things between the pre-Socratics and Kant. We could also start, of course, with a rationalist empiricist and what was going on in those traditions, dialogue with Descartes and Locke. Hegel had read at just about everything. Let's rush forward, though, to the philosophical legacy of Immanuel Kant. Hegel's absolute objective idealism is best understood as taking its point of departure from the task of getting over Immanuel Kant. It is precisely in knowing its limits that philosophy exists, Kant said. It's precisely in knowing its limits that philosophy exists. And his philosophy, especially the first critique, the Critique of Pure Reason, was an attempt to rein in the wild speculations of philosophy and restrict its range of inquiry to the limits of what we could actually know. Kant kind of approached philosophy like a gardener approaching an overgrown region. You know, a lot of this just needs to be trimmed back, and somewhere under there, there are clear lines and flower boxes, and we could get to them if we pull enough weeds and spray enough chemicals on here so that those things don't grow back. Only certain things can grow in a garden called philosophy. For Kant, our limits are set by our organs of perception. And he means several things by that, but he really is just talking about the five senses initially. He's got this empiricist thing informing his work. We can only know the sum total of what our perceptive faculties deliver to us. There may, of course, be other things beyond what our perceptive faculties inform us about, but we cannot know those things, like I just said. We need to carefully describe the limits of what we can know. So when I know a tree, I know what I know, the phenomena of the tree. What about the tree in itself? Not the tree as it appears to me, not those phenomena, but the tree as independent of me. You know, the very tree itself. Well, Kant draws a pretty firm line there and says, tree in itself is useful as a kind of a limiting concept. You can confess its existence. You could postulate it, but when you do, you've got to admit out loud that you're speaking beyond the evidence. You don't know tree in itself. You know the phenomenon of tree as it's presenting itself to you. So say so. Say so methodologically. Build it into your philosophical observations. Of course the tree is there in itself, I suppose, but by saying there, you're pointing to the phenomenon. Tree in itself would be noumena. I don't know if Kant made that word up or what he was thinking, but phenomenon is what I've got. Noumena is what I can postulate, but better admit I'm only postulating. Noumenal things must be, but you've never seen one and you never will. So we reckon with them all the time, and we do that best by sticking to the phenomenal realm. Time and space are, what are they, phenomenal or noumenal? Well, they're schemata, they're schematisms, they're organizing grids. That help me handle the various data. And things like causation, for instance, which Hume said, yeah, I can't find causation anywhere. Kant would say, well, causation's a necessary inference about how these phenomenal data are ordered and associated in my mind as I take them in. This doesn't change very much about our everyday experience. You still behave as you've learned to behave from all those physics experiments you did before the age of 3. But Kant gets a lot of mileage out of this in the field of ethics. It helps him put freedom and moral obligation in the realm of postulates of practical reason. Right? I've got to be good, and so I will postulate that there is such a thing as freedom and moral obligation, because there just has to be, because here I am being good. It's a postulate of practical reason. Free will can thus fit into a deterministic causal chain. So Kant's pretty happy to explore the way, well, everything that happens was caused by something, and that was caused by something, and so there's a chain of causal influences, and those are going on, and yet I'm free. I choose to do things, and I can be blamed or praised for those things I do. And yet, it's a mechanistic system. It's a closed causal nexus of determinism. Yet I'm free. How does that work? Well, Kant has a more complicated explanation of this, of course, in both in the Critique of Practical Reason and in his more directly ethical writings. But what it really comes down to is postulating that it must be there. You can't go look at it. It's in the noumenal realm. And I know it's in the noumenal realm because practical reason forces me to say so. This also applies to God, to make a jump to theology, who is certainly above the line of phenomenal stuff and certainly is not only noumenal, but even as a experience of God, this even applies to the question of whether we can have any phenomenal experience of the being of God. Kant himself said that he had ruled out knowledge of God in cases like this, precisely in order to make room for faith in God. So Dr. Kant swears that he is trying to help you be a good Christian. He wants to eliminate the possibility of knowledge of God, because then it's cool, you can have faith, right? That's what he said. Okay. Religious responses to Kant are legion. Here I'm going to speak more as a theologian, a little bit of a digression before we come back to Hegel, who is probably not doing a directly religious response, though that's one of the most disputed issues I've seen in Hegel scholarship. Religious responses to Kant are legion. What do you do if Kant's right? Well, conservative theologians who took Kant seriously in the 18th and 19th century tried a couple of things. Some theologians said Kant was right as far as he went, but then they claimed to have special sense organs that Kant lacked, a set of miraculous spiritual senses whereby God could be the object of knowledge. I have spiritual eyes, something like that. Kant maybe didn't, wasn't born again, didn't go to church. Others agreed that Kant had described the limits of knowledge correctly, but that God had somehow miraculously broken through those limits and revealed himself personally and propositionally in Christ and through the scriptures. So Kant's right, but a miracle happened. That's kind of cool. And it equips you to then use your Bible as if God had politely observed Kant's strictures about noumenal and phenomenal distinctions and then said, miracle, parting the Red Sea, here's a Bible, true facts about me in it, here's the Son of God incarnate. You could get a lot of exciting sermons out of that. Whether it's rationally defensible as a religious response to Kant is a totally different question. Schleiermacher, Friedrich Daniel Ernst Schleiermacher, I was going to spell that, but it would take all night, Schleiermacher, the father of modern liberalism, claimed that our experience of God was itself, here's Schleiermacher's move, in the Johnson House you read the speeches on religion, right? So you'll see this for yourself. Our experience of God is itself the experience of our relation to the totality of reality. And it enters our experience through, the German word here is Gefühl, and you could translate it feeling, but it's a particular kind of deep feeling of absolute dependence. When you feel yourself being carried on the surface of an unfathomable ocean of being, and it alone holds you up, but it always holds you up, and you are absolutely reliant on it. When you feel that, when the pervasive background of all existence comes to the foreground and makes you notice it, that is how you experience God. Schleiermacher believed that observed Kant's limitations, but pressed the experience of God into our actual experience. Don't know if that works either, but it can lead to some good sermons, especially in a kind of a romantic, pietistic mode. Similarly, romanticism in art, literature, and music, this whole romantic movement, made a virtue of necessity, derived a staggering amount of creative energy from the inaccessibility of what is most real in reality. That is to say, imagine yourself a romantic artist, either you're Beethoven at the piano, or you're Caspar David Friedrich painting, or you're, who am I leaving out, who's a great romantic poet from the period? Oh, Wordsworth and Coleridge. Coleridge, great reader and interpreter of Kant. God and beauty and goodness and truth and freedom and immortality, the very things most worth living for. Where are they? Not here, never here. Where are they? Beyond some kind of absolute barrier that Plato can't even imagine, right? This kind of Kantian distinction, everything I want and need and live for and feed on is there. Well, now what? Ah, I can derive tremendous creative energy from this lack. This is really an engine that can keep romanticism going. That impossible stretching is a kind of metaphysical translation of courtly love, if you imagine the kind of dynamic creative tension that created. Kantianism, oddly, can be the engine of a very robust romanticism, and I argue that it has been. If you think of romanticism as an attitude that is like, someone has described it as, like the longing of a moth to reach the light of the moon. Ah, you're going to die frustrated, but you're going to make some beautiful art on the way because of all that tension. Later forms of liberal theology, post-Schleiermacher, would argue on anthropological grounds, here's a whole other way around Kant. Well, Kant's right, but let's go study people. What do we know about people? Humanity just has religiousness built into its nature. Just as time and space have to be admitted as categories of experience a priori, even though you never experience space itself or time itself phenomenally, there's also a religious a priori, that's the phrase for late 19th century liberalism, a religious a priori, which imposes itself as a category of experience on everybody. And if you're not experiencing it, Christopher Hitchens, you're just wrong. You have a distorted, confused self-understanding, you modern protest atheists. So, with much less explicitly religious motivation, the movement of German idealism attempted to overcome Kant, not by dodging around him or tunneling underneath him or crashing into him or whatever the right metaphors are for these strategies, but by going over his head, just taking the high road and transcending that guy. Johann Gottlieb Fichte, F-I-C-H-T-E, Fichte, was the first to point out that if you know a limit, you already know something, some non-thematic region beyond that limit. Right? If you just tell me there's a wall there, I say, aha, that means there's something beyond the wall. Sort of like when modern physical cosmologists, whatever they're seeing in their mathematical equations, they then turn to you and say in popularizing voice, it's the edge of the universe. And every 8-year-old, including mine, say, what do you mean edge of the universe? What's past it? More space? Well, then that's more universe, right? Yeah, and I understand the physical cosmologists are doing something in their mathematical models, but when they make the jump to try to popularize that and communicate it with an image and they say edge of universe, they're doing something I think is kind of silly, right? If they're trying to bring me up to paradox, they should inform me so. That's fine. Or that space is curved, right? So again, I understand that I can't understand the math you're trying to simplify, but work harder on simplifying it for me. Anyway, if you describe this noumenal phenomenal barrier, you have already crossed it, Mr. Kant. If Kant established the boundary of the phenomenal and noumenal as the limit of our knowledge, he was himself crossing that boundary or even speaking from a position on the far side of it. Now, I don't know what you think about that. This struck the idealist as an absolute knockdown argument, and they all developed it and added to it in various ways. Fichte developed it with intense meditations on the nature of the knowing self and self-consciousness. Fichte would teach these wonderful classes where he would exhort his classes, "Gentlemen, think the wall. Now." And of course, they were all gentlemen, no ladies allowed. Now, think him who thinks the wall. Now, think him who thinks him who thinks the wall. I don't know how long he would keep this up, but apparently this was like, it's like morning calisthenics when you were at Dr. Fichte's lectures. Once you have exercised your mental muscles with these gymnastics of self-transcendence, and they really are pretty cool if you actually go through that kind of exercise and see, how far out can I meaningfully get? Like, can I think myself thinking the wall 6 times? Or do I get lost? It takes an ordered mind to get through there, very much of that. Once you've done the gymnastics of self-transcendence, you are ready to follow Fichte into his pronouncements about how man's fundamental nature is not simply to be a perceiving being, but to be an active being, an agent with moral connections. But for me to exist as a moral agent, I need to be able to act and make choices. And for this to be a possibility for this moral agent to act and make choices, there needs to be a field of reality that is not me. I can't just perform these self-transcending operations on myself. I got to have stuff. Well, since I exist and have to have stuff, voila, I make stuff through some mysterious process. What is that something, that place where I can be, that field within which I can be a moral agent, that material with which I can act out my moral agency? It's the empirical world for Fichte. In some sense, which I admit is not clear to me from the little Fichte that I've read so far, the ego creates the empirical world because the empirical world is needed in order to allow the ego to know itself. That's Fichte. That's kind of the first step over Kant. Now, the next important idealist is Schelling, who we've already talked about, Friedrich von Schelling. Von in a German name always means that you are of a noble family line. Schelling was not born noble, but was such a swell philosopher at such a young age that he attained nobility and was given some kind of dukedom or something and became Friedrich von Schelling. Johann Wolfgang Goethe did the same thing. He became von Goethe. He became noble. Schelling, a boy genius who produced not one, but at least three separate contradictory philosophies in his restless self-reinvention before age 35. Fichte was a boy genius too, but in a different way, not so much productive as receptive. Fichte was raised in a very poor family, and one time a businessman was coming through town and said, "Hey, I was late to church this morning. I had to be due out of town business, and I missed the sermon. What can I do? I can't go to the website. Where can I get the sermon?" And the pastor said, "Yeah, I don't really have it, but you know that Fichte boy? He could tell it to you." So the businessman went and asked the little boy Fichte, who was plowing, like, "Could you tell me the sermon?" Fichte dropped everything, said, "Yep," and just gave the sermon back verbatim. And the businessman thought, "This young fellow should go to college." So anyway, Schelling was also a boy genius, but instead of memorizing sermons, he was just able to, like, generate metaphysical views of the world and then set them aside like toys. Like, "I didn't like that one. Let me try another one." Totally different starting point, totally different metaphysic. Off he goes. He had done and published at least three of them, before he was 35, and then he took a break and didn't write anything for a long time, though he lectured and was academically active. One of his philosophies, everybody's favorite, was a kind of anti-Fichte system of nature. He and Hegel had teamed up on this critical journal of philosophy, and critical mainly meant anti-Fichte. Though they liked Fichte, they thought he was cutting edge, and they thought they had to take him down. What would an anti-Fichte idealist system be? It starts with lifeless matter. Lifeless matter, beginning from inorganic, evolves or emerges organic forms, a series of living things in higher and higher orders of complexity, finally producing, by emergent causation, a spiritual reality in the mind of man. Now, this is all before the Darwinian mechanism, right? This whole system is in place in order to account for other things. There must be first microbial life, then plant life, then animal life, then intelligent animal life. The highest form of life is not the philosopher, as Hegel clearly is going to say. The highest form of life is the artist, because the artist acts like a microcosm of nature. What does nature do? Create stuff. What does the artist do? Create stuff. But notice, the artist is the part of created stuff that creates stuff, so he's perfect. If you want that kind of intense self-consciousness that idealism feeds on, for Schelling in his philosophy of nature, it's going to be the productive artist. Creating more things, but doing it better with self-consciousness, thus taking nature's own creative activity to a higher, more spiritual, more inward expression. Now, that's Schelling. Hegel's first book, his first published book, was called On the Difference Between the Philosophy of Fichte and Schelling. So you can see what he's going to do here. You can already see how Hegel's absolute objective idealism is a bold attempt at beating Kant by taking the best from Fichte and Schelling. From Fichte, Hegel has the primacy of the self, though for Hegel it's a more intellectual self than the extremely moral agent of Fichte. While from Schelling, Hegel has the idea of human nature as continuous with nature and process, though for Hegel, the mind's immersion in matter, the very thing that got Schelling very excited, like, you know, when you're really being an artist is when you're, like, you got clay and you're, like, making stuff, and you're sort of like nature making stuff, but you're smarter. But you're mainly thinking about clay. That kind of immersion in the physical material is why an artist is better than a philosopher. Not for Hegel. That's a terrible thing, to be immersed in the physical material. In fact, the mind's immersion in matter is not a great creative moment of self-transcendence, but a moment of alienation, which must and will be overcome by a dialectical process. In Hegel's thought, the philosophies of Fichte and Schelling are thus canceled out and yet preserved and lifted up to a higher level. And that's kind of the magic. Canceled out, and yet preserved, yet lifted up. Hegel got a hold of a word, Aufhebung, which is a word that's used widely in German before this time, but in this idealist tradition, it's kind of pressed into service as a special term of art. Aufhebung, this lifting up, which is a kind of a cancellation and elimination of something, and yet a preservation of it, and yet a lifting up, maybe in that very act of canceling yet preserving, a transcending. Aufgehoben. Yeah, you've been aufgehoben. I was translating a German theological essay one time, and I got to the fourth line, and I thought, I should do this. I think it's within my skill range. I started into it. I got to the fourth line, and it had the word aufgehoben with reference to Christ and the resurrection or something, and I thought, I'm out. What do you do with the word aufgehoben? I actually had to go look it up and see, what do responsible translators do when a philosopher or theologian uses this word? Notice, though, that Hegel is doing this Aufhebung thing to Fichte and Schelling. He's taking what's best in their systems, he's affirming it, he's canceling their systems and getting past them to this next level. Aufhebung. To cancel, to preserve, to raise up. You may also have heard the popularization of Hegelian thought as thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. These are not Hegel's terms, so Hegel scholars will always yell at you and tear their garments if you say thesis, antithesis, synthesis. I'm not totally sure why, except they're being purists about sticking to Hegel's own terminology. He's certainly generated plenty of his own terminology. Let's use some of that. Though I will say the main problem with that kind of thesis, antithesis, synthesis, three-beat movement, that way of talking about the Hegelian dialectic, is it suggests that you put forth something, a thesis, and then something else that is its opposite comes in and contradicts it. So I have a thesis, someone else has an antithesis. The whole point for Hegel is I have a thesis, and if you sit and ponder it in Zen-like fashion long enough, you will notice that it has its own antithesis, that the thesis itself has its own negation and cancellation within it. That's the thing for Hegel. Now, it might, departing from my script here, the thesis, the thing posited, might give rise to its own contradiction, or it might evoke its own contradiction from outside. But even if it does evoke it from elsewhere, it is doing the evoking, right? Does that make sense? Anyway, so that's the Hegelian dialectic. You could say that it is positing its own negation or contradiction. Posits this cool word that kind of means puts out there. But it's doing so by way of alienation, becoming strange to itself, or recognizing that in itself there is something which is apparently foreign, but which is to be overcome, but which foreignness is to be overcome in this kind of reconciliation. So self and alienation and reconciliation. Notice again, when you're going to try to talk Hegel, you've got to do this thing where you say, then it does this, then it does that, then it does... What is it? Oh, Geist. Yeah. What is Geist? I don't know. I mean, I know. It's mind, spirit. You know, it's this spiritual thing that everything is. Now, Hegel had already done this three-beat dialectic in his very controversial Science of Logic, the three-volume Science of Logic, which is the main reason that analytic philosophers in the Anglo-American tradition refuse to read anything else from the rest of Hegel. There's a popular rumor out there that Hegel just flatly denies the law of non-contradiction. And you can hear him kind of doing it, right? Like, A is A, right? And not A? Well, come on, Zagan. I mean, it's A, and then it's sort of it, within itself. The more you ponder A, the more you realize that at least the notion of A has to posit non-A in order to define its own boundaries, right? So A and not A, but then that's really alienating. So we have to reconcile A and not A in B or A prime or, I don't know, something. Anyway, this is all in the Science of Logic. There he had argued, follow this argument. The attempt to categorize anything that is simply and immediately as being, right? Is this book being? Sure, let's categorize this as being. What do you do? Well, that's an attempt that both negates being itself or ends up categorizing everything else as nothing. And then this self-negation requires a resolution in the higher order category of, if you've got being and you have to get there by way of not being, what would the synthesis be? How would you Aufhebe? What would be the Aufhebung of being and not being? Becoming. Ah, becoming. Now that we can work with. How can we work with it? Well, what is becoming? Doesn't it include within itself its own negation? Yes. And this three-beat rhythm kind of drives things forward. This is just in the Science of Logic, right? We're not even talking about an actual historical process of becoming, but an analysis of the structure of logic itself, according to Hegel. Okay. Oh, and I'm going to skip this thing about the bad infinite. Hegel does the same kind of thing with the idea of the infinite, where he says, well, what is the infinite? Let's posit the infinite. Okay, there's the infinite. But as soon as I've said the infinite, I've kind of made a boundary around it. In fact, then if I put a finite thing up against it, what is that? I have to kind of carve the finite out of the infinite, which makes the infinite finite itself. And then that's messy because I wanted the infinite. So how can I have the infinite and the finite? Well, The kind of infinite you're thinking about that can be negated by the finite is the bad infinite, the schlechte Unendlichkeit. So what you need is the true infinite, which is not numerically derived, but is conceptually delimited. And it includes within itself the finite. Get it? Well, kind of. Hegel's really excited about that. So you get it in the science of logic. You get it in all kinds of strange conceptual analysis that Hegel unleashes on you. But you get it best in his masterpiece, The Phenomenology of Geist. Now, what's a phenomenology? The term phenomenology was coined by an 18th century German philosopher named Lambert, who used it to mean the study of the illusory aspects of an experience. Hegel took the term from Kant, who used it a lot, the word phenomenology. Kant, with his distinction between stuff we experience and stuff we can't experience, gave phenomenology of a new twist, because it's the logic of these phenomena that we can experience, as distinguished from the noumena, which we're not going to talk about, thank you. Hegel's phenomenology of spirit, then, attempts to describe what? The unfolding appearances of self-consciousness from its dawn to its full maturity. The unfolding appearances of self-consciousness. And again, you always have to stop and ask, whose self-consciousness? Not mine. Self-consciousness. Okay. Now, let me show you on history. This is the quote that's on the chart. I gave you a front chart that tries to kind of map where the phenomenology of spirit goes. For Hegel, the top thing you can talk about is the idea. That's kind of what gives, or the begriff, the concept. It's what gives, it's what makes you sure you're calling him the right thing when you call him an idealist. If you've got an idea, it's going to have this kind of three-beat movement of alienation and reconciliation. So logic is the idea in itself. But what is an idea in itself? Well, it presupposes, at least conceptually, the idea outside of itself. Well, that would be nature. Oh, logic and then nature. Nature is an alienated idea. That's terrible. I don't want alienation. Let's reconcile them. Okay, now you've got spirit, the idea in and for itself, right? Having made the trip out into nature. Now, then what you've got in each of these three boxes is a three-beat analysis of each of those things, of logic and nature and spirit. Logic, if you just think about rational thought, but again, not yours, you know, the universes or Geists, that's pretty clear. Nature, for Hegel, is a really important concept, both in contrast to logic and also in contrast to history, right? So Hegel's going to say nature's this sort of dead, inert stuff, and what we really want is spirit. But in order to have spirit, you've got to have this kind of externalization into dead, inert stuff, and then a picking up, a claiming of that into the movement of spirit. Now, if you can get that tension, you can kind of see how history is going to solve a lot of problems for Hegel. And here's my last big Hegel quote for you. Oh, but they're all good. I mean, all of these. You could just, they all do that weird, my head is buzzing Hegel thing. Look at the quote on history. Hegel says, "In contemplating world history, we must consider its ultimate purpose. This ultimate purpose is what is willed in the world itself." So I don't go read in some book what the ultimate purpose is. I look at what's happening in the world and say, this is the driving forward of the ultimate purpose. It's like a philosophical transmutation of an idea of providence. You see what's actually going on. "We know of God that he is the most perfect. He can will only himself and what is most like him. God and the nature of his will are one and the same. These we call philosophically the idea. Hence, it is the idea in general, in its manifestation as human spirit, which we have to contemplate. More precisely, it's the idea of human freedom. The purest form in which the idea manifests itself is thought itself. In this aspect, the idea is treated in logic." He could go on to say here, another form is that of physical nature, and he could go on to tell you where he treats the idea of nature. So there's thought, then there's nature. The third form, finally, is that of spirit in general. Spirit, on the stage on which we observe it, that of world history, is in its most concrete reality. So if you want to see spirit, if you want to see Geist, what stage is it showing on? The stage of world history. Right? And so when Hegel catches a glimpse of Napoleon at the Battle of Jena and sees him kind of commanding the city and running everything and says, here's a great world historical spirit, there's this kind of, he's not just starstruck with celebrity status or something, but he's actually thinking the drive of world history is spirit itself manifesting itself in a great man moving nations. Right? This has a lot of fallout for his political thought. Many people blame Hegel for the kind of totalitarian absolutism in politics that you can get. Certainly, Hegel always expresses what Barth calls an extreme form of self-consciousness, not of self-consciousness, of self-confidence, an extreme form of self-confidence in all of his philosophizing. Okay, that's where Hegel fits, and 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 that's where